So tonight is the fourth of this series of four talks I've been giving on the Brahma Viharas, divine abodes. And tonight we're going to talk about upekkha, usually translated as equanimity. The interesting thing about equanimity is that it sort of binds the other three. It supports them and binds them together. So in some sense, it's always taught at the end of a series of talks like this, because it's sort of, in a sense, where everything is headed. Right? Equanimity also appears in two other well-known lists. One is the Seven Factors of Awakening, which is a teaching on the progressive mind states that people can go through once mindfulness is established, so that when the wholesome mind state of mindfulness has arisen, then these steps go through and you end up, what a surprise, in equanimity. And then there's the Ten Paramis, which is another progressive teaching. And same thing, the last of the Ten Paramis is equanimity. So this is obviously, you know, since this is three really well-known teachings of the Buddha, three famous lists, it's like this is an important part of the Buddha's teachings. And so I want to share thoughts about it, essentially. This is the first from Sharon Salzberg's book, Loving Kindness. Equanimity is taught as the final meditation among the Brahma Viharas, because it provides the balance for loving kindness, compassion, and sympathetic joy. These others open one's heart to in a wish of well-being. May you be happy. May you be free from suffering. May your joy never cease. Equanimity balances these heartfelt wishes with the recognition that they are, that things are the way they are. However much we may wish for something more, most results are beyond our control. So this is like, oh, you know, yes, it's important that we well wish. Yes, it's important that we have thoughts of loving kindness and compassion. But don't get caught up in the idea that you're going to magically make everything wonderful. Because the world doesn't work that way, essentially. And it's good that we understand that. And equanimity is sort of that, sort of the balancing factor. And I'll talk a lot more about that as we go on. So this is another definition from Sharon Salzberg that I really like. And I want to talk about it for quite a while, actually. Equanimity is a spacious stillness of mind, a radiant calm that allows us to be fully present with all the different changing experience that constitute our world and our lives. That's an amazing statement, I think. In fact, I'm going to read it again. Equanimity is the spacious stillness of mind, a radiant calm that allows us to be present fully with all the different changing experiences that constitute our world and our lives. And I like this definition for several reasons. To start with, she uses the phrase, it's a spacious stillness of mind. When you're in a state of equanimity, your mind is still, yet spacious. It can take in whatever is arising, but stay in this state of equanimity. There's room for everything. You know, nothing's rejected, nothing's pushed away, nothing's clung to. It's just whatever's there, it's all okay. Joseph Goldstein has something to say about this, of course. This is from his book, Mindfulness. Equanimity, as one of these beautiful universals, is the mental factor called neutrality of mind. Bhikkhu Bodhi said that the Pali term could literally be translated as there in the middleness. Although this is an awkward construction in English, it does convey the balancing power of equanimity. Its characteristic is evenness, and when it is highly developed, it manifests as unshakable balance of mind. It serves to prevent either deficiency or excess in the other mental factors. So here's that balancing nature of equanimity again. So, you know, we when we talk about the others, we talk about sometimes about the near enemies. So for instance, you know, when we talked about loving kindness, we said that the near enemy of that is wanting, desire. Like, I'll love you, but I expect something in return. And equanimity, when equanimity is present, it's just another mental factor. When it's present, we see that desire arising and go, no, that's not necessary. I can just wish this person loving kindness without any expectation of anything. So equanimity is the balancing factor in that equation, in a sense. Here's another definition of equanimity I came across. It's from Rebecca Bradshaw. Equanimity is a continuous accommodation to the truth of the present moment. An equanimous heart mind can connect with this world in all its changes with balance, poise, grace, and flexibility. With equanimity, we learn to trust deeply and relax into our capacity to flow with the river of change. I like the phrase, the river of change. It's an image the Buddha uses all the time, you know. He talks about crossing the flood, and this constant flood, this constant river of things that are arising moment to moment, both at the level of mind and in the terms of body sensation, that never ceases. It's like always going. And we're learning to flow with that river of change. It's not that we're trying to stop it or change it or direct it or dam it up or, you know, channel it to make things, wonderful things happen. We're just trying to go with the flow, as the old hippies used to say, right? But that's what we're trying to do. We're just trying to be in that flow and acknowledge it and be okay with it without trying to do anything about it. Just be there with it. Another aspect of Sharon's definition is the phrase radiant calm. Equanimity is a radiant calm. Not only is our mind, you know, focused and still, but you literally become a source of this wholesome mind state for others around you. You actually radiate calm. Think how important that is in this world, especially the way things are today. And to be honest with you, probably how they were 2,500 years ago when the Buddha was around, but they just seem worse today because we're here today. But it's like, can I become a radiator of calmness for others? Seems like a really useful thing to do. Seems like a really wholesome aspiration or intention. And this is a really good answer to those people who say that the practice of meditation is selfish. It's like, oh, you're just doing that for yourself. You know, you're sitting there. You're not really doing anything. Well, actually, you're sitting there learning to become more and more radiant, more and more a source of calm and joy in the world. You know, there's that phrase, you know, don't just sit there, do something. And Sylvia Boorstein has this really great book that says, don't just do something, sit there. and I think it's a Sylvie's kind of witty, and I think it's very witty of her to come across that, use that phrase, and flip it over. But it's like the world needs this more than anything else, and it's the one thing, no matter what our physical capacity or our position in the world, this is all something we can do. There's no one here who can't just become a radiator of calm. So you go into, MacGuckin's Hardware, and things are a little busy, and you just become a radiator of calm. When you go to the checkout, you're just this calm person who just, and it just, it doesn't, it's not like a big deal, but it's like it affects people. You can, I see it all the time. That you, I can, just by being still and focused, I can affect the people around me. It's a very powerful thing to do, and be mindful of it and consciously try and actually manifest that is what the practice is all about in some sense. And then just another part of Sharon's phrase here. To be fully present with all the different changing experiences. To be fully present with all the different changing experiences. My notes here say this could be a definition of not suffering. Can we suffer because we cling to things or try and push things away? Instead, can we just be fully present with them, whatever they are? And it's like not be reactive to them. And I think it's a really another good definition of equanimity might be to be non-reactive. To be able to, no matter what's arising, not get caught in the habitual patterns of grasping or rejection. And just be with what's there now. Not try to figure it out, not try to fix it, just be able to be with it. And I'm not saying we don't have to be active in the world, but can we be active in the world from this place of equanimity? Instead, we're always trying to, hold on to things that are pleasant and push away things that are unpleasant, which is, we're not actually flowing with the river of change, as Rebecca Bradshaw said. In fact, we're doing the opposite. We're trying to, push against the river of change, trying to control it and dam it and channel it and do all kinds of things as opposed to just being in the flow. So these are all aspects of equanimity. One interesting thing, if you're like me and you read Dharma books and you listen to Dharma talks, and actually I've encountered this more in other traditions as opposed to the insight meditation tradition that I'm mostly involved in. But I talked about things having what I call near enemies. Equanimity, the near enemy of equanimity is indifference. Indifference is, it can look like, you can look, when you're indifferent, you can look very calm and very still and very together, but you're just totally detached. There's no heart connection with what's arising at all. It's like, yeah, I don't care. I don't care. And to be truly equanimous in connection with the other three Brahma Viharas, this is care deeply. It's the opposite, right? But unfortunately, you see this upekkha and upeksham, which is the Sanskrit, translated as indifference in a lot of texts. And I just want to point this out if you're studying texts, when you come across, this translated as indifference, that this is really incorrect. And speaking from my point of view, of course, I'm sure there's other people who argue the opposite, but it's indifference is narrow. It's self-serving. It's like, I don't care. I'm just going to sit back here and not be affected by the world. I'm going to go sit in a cave and just ignore everybody. It's not connected to, at the level of heart, with what's going on at all. And it certainly doesn't accommodate the present moment. It just ignores it. Doesn't care about the present moment. And equanimity, remember, because these Brahma Viharas are all interrelated and connected, equanimity is infused with loving kindness and compassion. There can't be equanimity without loving kindness and compassion being present as well. It's just, you can't separate these things. They're all, some people call the Brahma Viharas the four-sided jewel. Right? They're all, a jewel that has different aspects, and you look at it, over here, this looks like equanimity. Over here, it looks like, loving kindness. Over here, it looks like sympathetic joy. But they're all just connected together. They all sort of are aspects of each other and influence each other. So what's the significance of maintaining equanimity in our daily life? This is, once again, I want to read a little bit of Joseph Goldstein here. Why is this? I mean, we're talking about equanimity as a meditative state of mind, a meditative practice. But what about just in our day-to-day life? What's it mean to be equanimous when we're just going shopping or whatever it is we're doing? And this is what he calls the wisdom aspect of equanimity. The third manifestation of equanimity takes us deep into the experience of meditated awareness. The wisdom aspect of equanimity is beautifully expressed in the famous opening lines of On the Faith Mind by the third Zen ancestor. The great way is not difficult with those who have no preferences. When attachment and aversion are both absent, the way is clear and undisguised. Make the smallest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. So, equanimity, as I mentioned earlier, but I think I want to emphasize this, is to be non-reactive, to not get caught by all the things that are going on and going off in a tangent with one of them, mentally in particular. It's so easy to get caught by things that arise in the mind, especially things that are habitual, but also sometimes there's like some surprising things there. I like to think there's an image I like. The mind is like it's dropping fishing lines with hooks on them and really tasty bait into the, and these tasty bits of yummy stuff get dropped into the mind all the time, and we keep looking at them and going, that looks pretty good. Whether it's like, and then we go, and we chomp down on them, and then all of a sudden there we are, a hook in our mouth, flopping around again. That's what we do, over and over and over again, and in soft and subtle ways, and in big, huge ways, where we bite down and we're flopping around for half an hour, or half our life. Right? Instead of going, look, there's another interesting piece of bait floating in my mind, but I don't have to bite down on it. I can know it. I can be aware of it. I can even sort of be aware of the emotion that it generates when I see it. That's being mindful. But I don't have to sort of grasp it in any way. I don't have to cling to it in any way. It can just be there. Joseph goes on, practicing the great way, the equanimity of non-preferential awareness supports the development of all the awakening factors. So here we are talking about the seven factors of awakening, because these are all related teachings. As they become strong, we gain even deeper insights into the three characteristics: impermanence, not self, unsatisfactoriness. We start to, when the mind is equanimous, when the mind is still, and we start to actually not get caught by the things, the tidbits, the bait that keeps arising, but we keep seeing underneath everything, like, oh, there's just this constant flow of bait. You know, the fisherman never stops. There's just one piece of bait after another. And they're all the same. If I don't bite down on them, they're all the same. They're just things that arise, then they float by, and then they're gone. We know the truth of trains, not only as a conceptual understanding, but also in the direct experience of things arising and passing away. Sometimes this experience of impermanence is on a macro level, and then increasingly on a momentary micro level. At this point, our meditation is less involved with what it is that's arising than with the process of change itself. We experience the truth of dukkha, the unreliability and unsatisfying nature of conditioned phenomena, because it's always changing. We see the continual dissolution of everything that arises, at times even the momentary dissolution of consciousness itself. So our sense of a separate self even. All arises because equanimity is there. Equanimity is the base for seeing more deeply. And it's a mental formation. It just arises through practice, just like other things do. So, what is it that keeps getting in the way of us being equanimous? I mean, so far it's not like, well, we should all just be equanimous, I'm saying calmly, right? Well, except that stuff gets in the way of that more often than we'd like, perhaps. And one teaching I really like, that really helps me understand this, you know, is what are called the eight vicissitudes. I love the word. You know, these are gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute, pleasure and pain. These pairs of opposites that pull us one way or the other, right? So it's worth looking at these things. This is gain and loss, the first of these. Often thought in physical, financial terms, but also very relevant to our practice. We have a good sit, and then we think we've gained something. Then the next sit, or the next day or week, we have a bad sit, and we think we've lost something, and trying to figure out what we did wrong. We do this all the time. We have this idea, especially as we go deeper into the practice, and whatever good sit means, seems to happen more often. And then we go, we expect that's what's going to happen. We want that to be what happens. And then when it doesn't, then we label that time when it doesn't bad sit. This is just nonsense. You know, there's no such thing as good sits and bad sits. Either you sat or you didn't. End of discussion. You know, what happens in any particular individual sit is totally based on causes and conditions. You know, it could be that you that time you had the quote good sit, you'd be having a time in your life that was very sort of slow and steady and calm. Maybe for several days in a row, you had these really sort of nice, sweet, happy days. And so naturally, your mind is sort of settled. And then you have, you experience this sense of stillness and calmness, and equanimity arises. And you go, ah, now I've got it. But then the next day, you get a phone call and something, someone in your family's ill, and or who knows what, stuff happens. And then we sit, and it's chaos. The fact is, we sat. That's all that counts. We did it again. We sat down again. And this doesn't mean that if you don't keep your sitting practice really regular, you got to beat yourself up for not being a good sitter anymore. That's just another way to beat yourself up and, I've lost something because I didn't sit today. Stuff happens. Ideas happen, moods happen, life happens. And we just start again. Have another sit, see what happens. That's all we can do. Then there's praise and blame. It's really easy to get caught feeling good about praise and feeling bad about blame. Someone tells you, oh, you're just, you just gave a really great Dharma talk, Harry. I have to, every time someone says that, I have to, the little yellow warning flag has to go on my brain. Oh, that was just what I did. It wasn't like, I'm not special in any way. And other times people say, God, well, you're talking about today. I didn't understand a word you said. I have these experiences too. And it's like, oh, well, that one didn't work for that person. I did the best I could. End of discussion. And it's hard to do. I'm not saying this is easy. But it's like what we learn to do is to not be caught in wanting praise and doing whatever we can to avoid blame or to, self-justify. If someone blames us, then we get caught in some self-justifying argument about it. It's like, thank you for telling me that. That's the best response to blame is thank you for telling me. Let it be there. Then there's fame and disrepute. This is praise and blame writ on the larger scale, right? Fame, these only exist as thoughts in other people's minds. I thought that was a really good definition of fame and disrepute. This is just how other people are reacting to whoever you happen to be, whatever you present to be. And somehow or other, some people will become famous. But have you noticed that people who become famous often then go through the swing into disrepute? Look at anything that goes on in the political arena or the entertainment arena or whatever. It's always like people are famous, and then the more famous you are, the more likely it is you're going to fall into disrepute and get blamed for stuff you said or didn't say, or how you said it, or how you're dressing, or how come you're not doing concerts in the South, or what are you, who knows? This stuff, right? It's just all mental arisings that, that other people are experiencing that you just have to let it all go. You can't let it reflect in any way how you act in the world and how you speak in the world. It's hard because it's like, our whole culture is talked about, everybody deserves 15 minutes of fame, right? That little thing that goes on in the world. Who knows? And then pleasure and pain. This is like, we have to understand that changes are inevitable. Right? We get some pleasure. We get something that we really like. And then we get some pain because it disappears. Or something else arises that's not pleasant. 5 minutes after all that pleasant stuff, something happens. I was talking to this really wonderful man at the hospital today. He was just sitting eating in his famous favorite Chinese restaurant here in Boulder 2 days ago. I mean, just like 2 days ago. He's saying, oh, and he's ordering his favorite food and he was going to sit and have lunch and eat this wonderful stuff. And he got these really severe stomach pains that had started just before he was eating. So it wasn't had anything to do with the food. And all of a sudden, he was in absolute agony within an hour or two. And he actually had to be rushed to the hospital and eventually had an operation and had, 60 centimeters of his small bowel removed. And it was like, just like that. He was having this pleasant day, gonna go out to lunch and have a good time. Just like that. Pleasure and pain just happen. And it's like we can't get attached to either of them. It's okay to enjoy pleasure. It's okay to go, ugh, pain, who wants that? But it's like that's what you get. And sort of try and keep the balance of it. It's the cycle of life. It's perfectly, absolutely neutral. And it's not our fault. If something unpleasant happens, it's not our fault. If something pleasant happens, it's not our fault either. Maybe fault isn't the right word there, but it's just like stuff happens. Things arise. But it's these things, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute, pleasure and pain, that constantly pull us away from having equanimity. Because these are the things we react to over and over and over again. These are the famous list of reactive mental arisings and physical arisings too, but these are mainly mental. And it's like we have to just be aware that this is what life is like. Stuff happens. And we can't let any of it get in the way of just being who we are and doing whatever we can to stay equanimous and stay in the flow of change. These are all just things that float along in the river of change, and we bump into them, or they bump into us more likely. It's stuff that happens. Then there's the really interesting thing. All of the Brahma Viharas have phrases that are used in practice. And the phrase that for equanimity, I think, is really interesting because it points to something that I know I've certainly found difficult in my life and in my practice life for that matter. It says, this is the phrase that you would repeat over and over again. You are the owner of your karma. Your happiness or unhappiness depends on your actions, not on my wishes for you. Your happiness or unhappiness depends on your actions, not on my wishes for you. And if you think of this as like some random person on the street, well, of course. Then you think, oh, what about my child, or my partner, or my parents, or someone I'm close to? Somehow, all of a sudden, now our thoughts are supposed to create their happiness. We're responsible for them being happy. This is so deeply embedded in our cultural beliefs. But the truth is, you can't be. Everyone is responsible for their own happiness. And I'm not saying for one second that you can't do things for someone else that might potentially create causes and conditions such that more happiness might arise in their life. But whether or not that actually happens is not up to you. You can't make anyone happy. You can create causes and conditions such that they might become happier, whether it's momentarily or long term, who knows. But you, yet we've, and the same, and you take, now take this phrase and think about it in terms of, instead of you, I am the owner of my karma. My happiness or unhappiness depends on my actions, not on my wishes. Yeah. My father had this great phrase he'd use. If wishes were horses, then beggars would ride. It's a very British statement, but like it's really, if wishes were horses, then beggars would ride. We all have wishes. And it's not, there's nothing wrong with having wishes, as long as you don't expect anything to happen from them, other than, you know, maybe sort of enjoy the fact that you, but I wish I could go get some ice cream right now. Oh, but I can't do that. I'm sort of listening to this Dharma talk. It'd be rude for me to leave. But you can sort of enjoy the wish. Like, oh, yeah, that'd be nice. I'll do that later. And just, but so it's like, but it's like we have to watch how we think we can control our happiness by just wishing for things. I wish things would be different in my life. I wish this would happen or that would happen. Yeah. And once again, I'm not saying you shouldn't have wishes. You shouldn't try and have things happen that would make you happy. It's just natural. It's a normal thing to do. But it's not like you can make the wishes come true. You can just do what you can to create the causes and conditions such that they might be true, that they might happen, but that's all you can ever do. And then you just have to, with equanimity, go, oh, that didn't work. It's okay. You have to let it, because you're in that flow, and it's part of the, those wishes are just part of the flow, in a sense. And you're floating along with the wishes for a while, and then the wishes go one way and you go another. That's that. And this is even more important, and I wonder if it's this when it comes to other people, thinking that somehow you're responsible for their happiness. It's so hard to take that in, because we want to be responsible. We want to make that person happy. That person's really unhappy right now. I want to make them happy. Why do we want to make them happy? Because we're unhappy when they're unhappy. Because we care for them. And so we do these little things that might create the cause, like I said, create the causes and conditions for their happiness. But that's all we can ever do. That's all we can ever do. And then their happiness will arise when they're ready to take those things in. That's all you can do. And it's like, I have a note here. So what is the significance of equanimity in our meditation practice? So, and I want to just emphasize this. It's from the mental state of equanimity, this mental formation that arises when all the conditions, causes and conditions are such, because we put energy, a lot of energy, into our practice to create the causes and conditions such that equanimity can arise. Concentration, effort, being awake, being very mindful. And then when that state arises, when equanimity is there, then the practice has this shift away from paying attention to the details, to paying attention to the underlying process. Things are arising and changing. Nothing is permanent. No matter what we think, there's always going to be dukkha. There's always going to be things that aren't the way we like them to be. We can never create this place where our life is perfect. Well, maybe for like 5 seconds or so. But that's about it. Then something's going to change, no matter what we do. And then we start to see that in all of these things that we keep seeing that are arising and changing and disappearing, there's no self there. There's no separate entity there at all. This is what equanimity gives us the chance to see. And we get start to see things in a different way because the mind is clear and still and focused. And these things arise in our practice. Something else from Joseph Goldstein here. And this is just a little note. We experience the truth of selflessness when we see nothing lasts long enough to be called self. That's a great explanation to me. We experience selflessness when we see nothing lasts long enough to be called self. All phenomena arise out of the appropriate causes and conditions. Unsubstantial, empty of any inherent self-existence. Phenomena are like rainbows, colored light arising out of momentary changing conditions, both vivid and insubstantial at the same time. Isn't that a good definition of a rainbow? It's vivid and insubstantial. It's just the way light's reflecting in the sky with the moisture, the way the angle of the sun. That's all it is. He also talks about equanimity as a parami, and I just love this one sentence. You know, because paramis has a slightly different list than other things. One of the main paramis, I think, it's really important to understand is patience. If we can have patience with our practice, you know, we practice and then we want something to happen. I want this to be wonderful. I want to have that thing like it says in the book, you know, or that, what that teacher described one day or whatever. So patience is fairly high on the list in the paramis, actually. I think it's number 7, 6 or 7. It says, of these, patience and equanimity are considered the mainstays for all the others. If we can have equanimity and patience, then our practice blossoms on its own. It's like patience and equanimity. It's an interesting angle on the practice, I think. It's like we often forget, like we sort of think, well, I've got equanimity, now I want something exciting to happen, please. Well, maybe. Maybe not. Patience, patience, patience. Just keep coming back as best you can. Create causes and conditions through your practice where it's more likely that equanimity arises. And see what happens. And this is such a big night, I have 2 poems. So, this first one is Dana Falls from her book Going and In. It's called Remember This. Vast and changeless, the ground of being is not wrought by ripples on the pond. The firmament from which we spring, the divinity at the heart of things, doesn't wax or wane with mind states or wither in the wind. We come from stronger stuff than feelings. Essence does not fail or fade, diminish or trade reality for illusion. We are wordless, wide, and wise beyond time. Within us is a flame of truth that never dies. Let that be the focal point of life. Let that be the light that guides us from the shadows. Within us is a flame of truth that never dies. I can live with that one. But then, slightly different angle. This is from Mary Oliver's book, Evidence. And it's just the last section of a longer poem called To Begin With the Sweet Grass. What I loved in the beginning, I think, was mostly myself. Never mind that I had to, since somebody had to. That was many years ago. Since then, I've gone out of my confinements, though with difficulty. I mean the ones that were thought to rule my heart. I cast them out. I put them on the mush pile. They will be nourishment somehow. Everything is nourishment somehow or another. And I've become a child of the clouds and of hope. I've become the friend of the enemy, whoever that is. I've become older, and cherishing what I've learned, I've become younger. And what I risk to tell you this, which is all I know, love yourself. Then forget it. Then love the world. There's so much wisdom in poetry. That's all I have to share tonight.